We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Ravi Sood, investor, entrepreneur, and chairman of Golconda Gold and Abraxas Power Corp. Ravi, thanks for joining me today.
Great to be here again, Tom.
You know, it's kind of crazy to me to think about the last time we spoke. Of course, I went back and listened to the last interview we did with you, which was in May of 2020. And man, what a different place the world is. You know, in our pre-chat this morning, you started telling me a little bit about, you know, how you have really tried to understand money, what it is, and how it works. So maybe we can start there and share with us a little bit about your experience, some of the teachers that you've had. And we've got a lot of interesting different branches to go on this conversation.
Yeah. I mean, great starting point, Tom. And I think, I could have said this probably several times over the past 10 or 20 years, but wow, what an interesting time to be thinking about this topic and asking these questions. And I find myself looking back frequently and reflecting. I started my career in the investment business, ultimately a CEO of an investment firm based in Toronto and one very much focused on natural resources. I'd like to think I was a well-read, well-educated, thoughtful investor. And maybe in some ways I was. I certainly had access to fantastic resources from a macroeconomic standpoint, a great honor and pleasure of working for many years, over 10 years directly with John Crow. He was in my office and very much involved with our operations. He was a former governor of the Bank of Canada. Prior to that, the director of the IMF for North America. Also had the opportunity to work directly with Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve. I was on our board of directors, Dr. Sidney Jones, former deputy secretary of the Treasury. Unbelievable macroeconomic resources and sources of information and learning for someone like me. Mm-hmm. And still with, you know, I'm not trying to be falsely self-deprecating here. I can look back and say I truly had no understanding of how money worked. Mm-hmm. And it's so fundamental to everything. You're in capital markets. Why are stocks or markets going up? Why are they going down? Why are currencies doing what they're doing? Why are commodities doing what they're doing? And then, you know, these are the things I'm supposed to understand. And I can look, to this day, not a week goes by that I'm not learning something new. So this is, I mean, how money works is so fundamental, so important, and yet so arcane and so poorly understood. It's something that now with what's happening and what's transpiring globally and in capital markets, we got to spend more time thinking about this and talking about it and trying to answer these questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, trying to understand how that ends up, you know, with the intersection of gold and let's say Bitcoin, any of these harder assets and, you know, what that growth in the money supply ends up meaning for all of these physical, tangible objects, right?
Well, absolutely. And what is what is gold's role in all of this? Those of us who live in the world of gold and gold bugs and every, you know, first and second derivative of this group of people and group of investors or group of thinkers, we've had views and the views have evolved over the last 50 years. You know, 1971, a departure from sound money. It was supposed to be temporary, cause for concern, but it was going to be temporary. And, it seemed like the right decision at the time for a combination of reasons. We cruised into the 90s and we had a U.S. government in the Clinton era that ran surpluses. Not much cause for concern. The new way of doing things, the new system seemed to be largely working, a market-based system. Mm-hmm. And that was the prevailing economic theory. What's there to worry about? And now at that point, 30 years had gone by. And then we get into the zeros and we have the stock market bubble burst in 2000, We had, an important event for the world and for capital markets is with September 11th. And we had more cause for concern. The math started to look a bit different. Mm-hmm. And you had thought leaders, I'll use the name Eric Sprott, just to name one, starting to sound the alarm. But again, you had 30 years into it where the system was largely working. And, as humans, we're all victims or outcomes of our human psychology. And there's confirmation bias. That's one of the dominating themes in how we think and act.
And recency bias, of course.
And recency bias. And it recency bias, times 10 here, because it had been a generation at this point before, since we had the departure from sound money. So what's the problem? We get to the global financial crisis, 2007, 2008, and we have very serious cracks emerging. They're obvious to, let's say, everybody, because it's hit Main Street. This is not an arcane leveraged hedge fund long-term capital in 98 or an Asian currency crisis in 97. These are things that very few of us can wrap our heads around. Why was that an issue for me? I don't know. But 2007, 2008, that hit almost everybody. It hit Main Street and it was a global thing. It wasn't isolated by any means. And we had this massive policy response. At that point in time, I'd say the math became obvious to anybody who's willing to do the math. This was on track. Maybe there's still some cause for hope at that point, but we appeared to be on track for what I call an intractable problem, a mathematician by training. And what we mean by intractable problem is one that there is no solution. So the debt situation in Europe, the debt situation in the United States, the developed world, you could lump Japan in there too. It's a different beast for a variety of reasons, but it's part of the problem, not part of the solution. That put us on a path for a problem that we can't solve. How are we going to get out of this? But you use the term recency bias. I use the term confirmation bias. It had been an entire generation. Now we're tracking on almost 40 years of a departure from sound money. And the system still, by all the markers, there's no fire alarm going off. The stock market looked pretty good coming out of it. We're all making money. Gold didn't go to 10,000. Everything seems fine. Interest rates are pretty reasonable. It's all still kind of working. Sure, we have our problems. The system's still working. Not only have I not seen a problem, my dad's never really seen a problem. It's all been going the right direction. The system's hung together. And then we have a response from gold. What's our response from gold from the 07, 08 financial crisis? Well, like any asset, it dipped. Went down about 20% initially. It was a source of liquidity for people and the flight to liquidity. I won't say flight to quality. And then it promptly more than doubled. In 2011, August 2011, we hit a high of $1,921 per ounce and then spent the next decade doing a round trip, minus 50% and then back up to where we were. Again, where's the fire alarm? The traditional fire alarm, gold, interest rates, nothing saying there's anything catastrophically wrong. And when we have something that we've never seen before, a global pandemic, not in our lifetimes anyways, and still the system still seemed to work. We had this huge policy response to the pandemic. And again, the system hung together. And, we saw Bitcoin starting to react. And it's one of the individuals I like to follow. And I think has a lot of really insightful things to say. Luke Gorman said, maybe Bitcoin's the last remaining fire alarm or smoke detector that the policymakers, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury hasn't been able to turn off or take the batteries out of because they can't control it. And so they've been controlling interest rates, controlling gold, perhaps. So all the smoke detectors have been turned off. They had the power shut off on them. But here we have Bitcoin going wild. Hey, is something really wrong? And now in the last few weeks, last couple of months, we've seen our traditional smoke detector gold really take off. It's blinking red. And we're seeing all-time highs in gold prices. We're starting to see that reaction through the entire commodity complex. What's different now? What all that math that I talked about that started to become obvious in 2007-2008, it's all still the same math. Mm-hmm. What's changed now that gold can go to all-time highs and we can have this fundamental change in price? That's the questions I think it's worth asking. And, you know, by asking those questions and probing, maybe we can get to an understanding of what's gold's role as part of the global system of money going forward. And how does it interact with all these other things that, you know, that we're talking about and that we have to pay attention to right now?
Mm-hmm. So Ravi, you know, there's so many things I want to ask there, but, you know, maybe we can pull on that thread a little bit more. How do you see, you know, gold's role as changing now, you know, considering again, the last time we spoke was May of 2020. We did not know what the policy responses, what the fiscal and monetary responses were going to be, not only in the US, not only in Canada, but all over the world, and how that ends up affecting the price of these, you know, really these tangible goods, these benchmarks for the rest of, in a way, the valuation of everything else.
Yeah, and I think we have some more information than we did just 4 years ago. And a couple important things have happened in terms of the global money system. And, you know, maybe they were obvious at the time, maybe not. Maybe we should have paid more attention to them when they happened. The first one, and I'd say maybe the most important one in terms of what's different. And, you know, famous last words is somebody in the investment business of this time it's different. But what's different this time with gold and the price action and what's happening globally? In 2018, we saw a break. We saw the Chinese starting to put in place a system to pay for oil in yuan. So breaking from this decades-long, over 40-year-old system of being exclusively traded in U.S. dollars. The volumes were small initially. Those volumes have increased over the last 6 years. And now you have other countries part of that. An accelerator to that was 2022. We saw Russia invade Ukraine. And what's the important there? Obviously, a lot of important things happening because of that and related to that. But one thing I'll pick on, the seizure / forfeiture of Russia's U.S. dollar reserves. And we're talking big numbers. And so, okay, part of the sanctions, part of the move on Russia. But what is that message that was sent? You know, neither here nor there on the views of any of these countries or that conflict in particular. But the message was sent is if you do something the U.S. government doesn't like, your U.S. dollars are not worth anything. That it means, you know, it's what we suspected all along or what was always there on the fine print on page 57 is it's not really a neutral reserve asset. It is not because, you know, China invades Taiwan and it doesn't matter how many trillion U.S. dollars they have. They can forfeit them. They can seize them.
Or at least the possibility of that is there, right?
Exactly. And that possibility is so much more real now post Russia, Ukraine. So let's overlay these two things. We now have an ability to trade commodities in a currency other than dollars and a meaningful one, the yuan. Mm-hmm. The largest oil importer, one of the largest oil importers for the foreseeable future is now buying and has the ability to settle in its own currency and other currencies. And then you overlay that with a policy response or an action from the U.S. government that sends a clear message to every other government in the world that those U.S. dollars that are sacrosanct, that are the world's reserve currency, maybe aren't really. And now you might have thought it was the case before, but now you know it's the case. So now we have those two things happening at the same time, and it's not just oil; it's the most important one by far. Mm-hmm. But for oil, for gold, for every other commodity, at the margin, the price is not necessarily set by the U.S. dollar. At the margin, it's a meaningful amount of volume being traded in other currencies. And what does that mean? That means that it accelerates the trend that's been going on for many years, which has been driven by demand and GDP growth, asymmetric GDP growth of the East. And I'll say the East, meaning specifically China and India in this case, having much more of effect or maybe all of the effect at the margin to set the price for those commodities. Mm-hmm. And so boil it down to even more simple than that. Now that the U.S., maybe they could control the gold price in dollars, they can't control it in renminbi. And if gold can go up in renminbi, it can, on a relative basis, buy more energy. It can buy more oil. It gets more bang for its buck in China. So that gold is worth more in China in very physical terms, chemical terms. How much energy is that gold worth? It's worth more over there. And money, like everything else in this universe, obeys the laws of physics. You pour water, it goes down. It'll find the cracks, it'll go down. If money is worth more over here, the arbitrage, the whole system that we've built of interconnectedness and globalization, it will move it over there. Mm-hmm. And what have we seen happen? What have we seen accelerate? And that you don't have to, you know, be a clairvoyant here. You don't have to read the tea leaves. It's there on your screen every single day. What's the physical premium on gold in China to the paper price in Western markets? That's sending all that gold that way. And again, at the margin, as you take that gold out of the system, what are the data points to corroborate that? What's happening to LME inventories? What's happening to the LBME? What's happening to physical gold everywhere? I see it myself in my own gold business, where we have two mines that produce concentrate. So we don't produce gold bars. Gold bars go to London, you sell it, it's like cash. Mm-hmm. With concentrate needs to go somewhere to be processed and then turned into gold. And the amount of interest in our concentrate, whereas in, let's say, 2018 or 2019, I was making 100 calls and I got no responses. Now I get messages on LinkedIn, email, every possible platform anyway to try and get a hold of me, saying, do you have any, from guys I've never heard of, in from refineries I've never heard of, saying, do you have any concentrate? Mm-hmm. It's all of these are data points that corroborate that thing that, again, I said, you don't have to do all this work to figure it out. It's just there on your screen every day with that physical premium in China. That gold's going that way. And the ability to control gold price is lost. And that, I think, is what's transpired. All the math is the same. All the arguments are the same as they were 2007, 2008. And for the more forward-thinking people like Eric Sprott, 10 years before that. But now the reality is set in, and the ability to kick the ball down the road is gone. The other thing I'll overlay, I'm going on here, but the other thing I'll overlay with that is that maybe this time is different, is that the best thing for the United States of America may very well be much higher commodity prices in dollar terms and a much lower dollar. And that may be the best solution. There is no silver bullet or easy exit plan or soft landing out of this intractable problem that's been created with the debt super bubble. Mm-hmm. But I'll make a Star Trek reference here, which is the Kobayashi Maru. And the Kobayashi Maru test is, what do you do in a situation where you're guaranteed to lose? That's an important test of character, maybe an important test of how somebody thinks. Mm-hmm. So if I'm in charge of an economy and I have all the data, and don't for a second think that these people at the Federal Reserve or the Department of Treasury aren't absolutely brilliant people. I've worked with a bunch of them directly. Mm-hmm. They are absolute geniuses for the most part. They may seem like blithering idiots at times. How can they be doing? They don't understand what's going on. They have a better understanding than we think, and they're doing what they need to do to kick the ball down the road and manage this Kobayashi Maru situation, a situation where you're guaranteed to lose. You're trying to figure out how to lose the best. And the way for the U.S. government to lose the best, which maybe means for the rest of the world, is for a much lower dollar and much higher prices as a result of all physical commodities in dollar terms. Fixing your debt to GDP issue in real terms by deflating the real value of the dollar, giving your economy the ability to manage higher interest rates and deal with inflation and other factors that you need to deal with, which you don't have when you have 120% debt to GDP. And also a much lower dollar has a hugely stimulative effect on stocks and on receipts. And going back to the Clinton era with, NASDAQ 5000 on the way up, the tech bubble and, the U.S. government running surpluses, that's what we want to get back to. That's our Kobayashi Maru best way to lose path out of the current intractable situation that we find ourselves in.
Interesting, Robbie. So as you say, this is, you know, the best solution for the problem that they are facing, right? What does that mean in terms of, you know, considering how rich, how commodity rich the US is, does that lower dollar mean, you know, more demand able to come in and purchase commodities from the US if we can get out of our own way to start producing in a meaningful way again?
Absolutely. So it means so many things. It means more power to US producers, exporters, debilitating effect on importers, so therefore reducing and impugning imports, helping fix the trade balance. It definitely makes producers of any good, or even for that matter, commodity in the United States, that puts them in a better position than a strong dollar. They're fundamentally disadvantaged with a strong dollar. At times, a strong dollar has been the exact right policy for the United States. Right now, the United States needs a situation where you have negative real rates. So your inflation exceeds your interest rate. And as a result, when you have negative real rates, like we did coming out of World War II, you deflate the real value of that debt. Your GDP can grow faster and you can get to those. You can fix your deal with your trade imbalance. You can deal with your deficits and you got that exit path. That's in my mind, that's the Kobayashi Maru solution of losing as best we can and managing our way out of this situation. Of course, capital markets are, again, I'll put my mathematician's hat on again. They are what we would call a chaotic system. You put the 1,000 most, brilliant people in a room to try and figure out a solution to have a soft landing, the smooth exit path, and it ain't going to happen. You're going to have unbelievable chaos and volatility in that trajectory. And it's going to be full of opportunity for investors. And it's also going to be full of disasters for people too. It's going to be a very interesting time.
Absolutely. There's just so many inputs into that system to have any perception that you have control over that system, I think, is foolish.
Yeah. Well, and we tend to, you know, think the all-powerful Fed and the saying, and it's, I think there's a lot of wisdom in the saying, don't fight the Fed. You can go counter trend massively. Like what I said earlier, everything in the world went right for gold in 2007, 2008, and it went down 20% first before it went up 2.5x. If you have a negative real rates for a prolonged period of time and you have a secular decline in the US dollar, that could be wildly bullish for stocks. And you could have, you're changing the denominator too, right? It's a little bit of fun with numbers. And, stock ABC that's worth $100 today may be trading at $500, but maybe 80% of that gain is because you deflated the value, the currency that it's marked in. So it might be wildly bullish for stocks, just as an example, but stocks might go down 25% in the next 12 months on their way to doubling and tripling. So it tremendous volatility in any chaotic system. And this is like we're turning a lot of dials and pulling a lot of levers here. Crazy stuff.
So Ravi, with your experience of learning from, you know, these, in some ways, people that are pulling those levers and that have that experience of pulling on those levers of money, obviously, you know, I'm sure you've read a lot of, let's say, Austrian economics. How does that understanding of money and how it works square with the Keynesian school in your mind? And how does that intersection play with each other? You know, should we be thinking far more of Keynesian economics rather than this, I don't want to say pie in the sky, but, you know, this world that I think we would all as gold bugs appreciate more being the Austrian school that is, I think, far easier to understand rather than dealing with the reality, let's say, of Keynesian economics?
I think the facts are forced upon us. We don't have the ability to choose, and it's not like it's like, oh, this is, you know, we should just fix that. this is 50 years in the making. And so we're on a path, and so it's a Keynesian path that we're set upon at this point. Austerity is not a solution. You've got I'll sidetrack.
Not a good solution.
Yeah. Well, it's unpalatable for me. Apologies here. I'll take us off on a tangent and hopefully loop back here. But look at you have over $3 trillion a year of entitlement payments in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Just shy of $1 trillion military. Politically, and just realistically as a society, okay, the military one maybe, but what can you shave off at 10%, 20%? What's $100 billion? Not going to do much. That $3 trillion of entitlement payments, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all those numbers, they're almost untouchable. And those numbers are only going in one direction.
And don't forget the interest on the debt.
The interest on the debt. These things are politically you just can't touch these. Totally not palatable to in a meaningful or relevant way. Meddle with those numbers or those payments. They're not going anywhere. So whatever we do in austerity, it's almost at the margins, doing almost nothing. Mm-hmm. So again, it puts us on the path of that we need some sort of monetary solution. I'll call it a Keynesian path that we're inexorably put on here. And again, it's 50 years in the making. There's no way to get off this track that we find ourselves on. And it's really, whether we want it or not, that's the trajectory that we're on at this point.
So Ravi, you also mentioned earlier that, you know, Luke Gromen's idea of Bitcoin being one of these smoke alarms that the Fed at this point can't control. Do you think that the advent of the ETFs and then let's say the banks starting to, you know, control and understand the Bitcoin miners as well is, you know, the first steps in starting to control Bitcoin a little bit more?
Absolutely. Any financial instruments or financialization of it, and I suppose financialization in our conventional sense of, turning things into securities that can be traded in a conventional manner, or adding tools to the toolkit of those who would control it. I think, cryptocurrencies have been a fascinating topic. As a mathematician, I'm absolutely been enthralled by just absolutely enthralled and enamored of cryptocurrencies. As a student of money, trying to understand what role they're going to play going forward, I have no answers yet. I have a lot of questions, and the questions I have are called more thought bubbles or observations that we have. Governments are part of our life, and they're not going anywhere. And there's some of us are on the left, some of us are right, some of us are libertarian, some of us are big government, and we're a society. But governments are there, and they're part of it, and it's part of humanity, how humanity functions. Things that governments need and like to do include charging taxes, collecting them. That's their source of revenue. They like to control money flows. That's what gives a government power, like monetary policy, fiscal policy, controlling where money goes, having that ability. They also, they like to monitor where that money is. All of these things, cryptocurrencies, and I'll focus on Bitcoin, are excellent at avoiding all of the above. And I mean, reductio ad absurdum, like let's say we paid for, Bitcoin was very easy to use and I could pay for my tradespeople. I could pay for everything I need or most of the things I need in daily life and not pay taxes. I could move all my money to some tax haven. I could do a lot of things. And, I'm oversimplifying things here. Mm-hmm. It's really good at a lot of those things. Those are things governments don't like. The contrapositive would be a central bank issued digital currency or so-called CBDC. Now, if it's a central bank doing it, it's no longer decentralized, lose some of the magic and some of the beautiful mathematics of it. But if we switched lock, stock, and barrel to CBDCs, boy, governments would have infinite control over taxation, over flow of funds, they'd have a whole new set of tools in their toolkit in terms of being able to stimulate the economy and to be able to sort of drive behaviors that they want. We want you to spend less on housing and spend more on this type of consumption. We want you to spend more on American automobiles and less on Japanese automobiles. I mean, you could just go on forever of ideas that governments could come up with that may or may not suit them in the indeterminate future. And CBDCs would be unbelievably effective at giving them that toolkit. One of my observations or thought bubbles or concerns for cryptocurrencies in general is that they would just be so powerful in the hands of, or perceived and in actuality so powerful in the hands of governments, that once they have the ability to do that, then they're going to take a much more harsh stance on the call it the true cryptocurrencies, the ones that are truly distributed, decentralized, and doing what crypto is supposed to, you know, working the way crypto is supposed to work. And at that point, I mean, you don't have to create ETFs and figure out how to short them. You can make all the off ramps into the real world economy illegal or heavily taxed or very difficult to do. You just make the world difficult for crypto. So right now, there's very little incentive for governments to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, what's the benefit? And let's look at the United States in particular. A bunch of people made a lot of money off of crypto, stimulated some new industries. Okay, there's some complaints about it being, you know, used for criminal activity. That's, I mean, marginal money. You know, money of all forms is used for criminal activity. I think that's a spurious argument against cryptos. Is that? It's not really harming anybody, including the government, or in trivial ways. So there's very little incentive for them to really be bothered by it. This smoke alarm concept, okay, maybe that's annoying that they can't turn that smoke alarm off, to use Luke's vernacular. But I think this is small beer. Where they really put their mitts in it is when they have a viable alternative that they're really excited about, which would be a CBDC. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that's looming. Every major economy in the world is working on a CBDC, and it's being trialed in various places. So this, you know, again, I come back to the point, this is like an interesting intersection of all this happening on a macro point of view, the intractable problem, the Kobayashi Maru solution or potential solution. And now you got to overlay cryptocurrencies. And what does that mean? Is that the new neutral reserve asset? Another thought bubble I'll throw out there in terms of, I'll call it the practicality, not a technicality of cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. Trillions of dollars of gold is held by central banks, the IMF, the people who are, whether we like it or not, deciding how money works. They hold a lot of gold. And maybe it's not zero, but for all intents and purposes, they hold zero cryptocurrency. So from a practical standpoint, all the guys are the puppet masters holding the strings, and they might be more powerful or less powerful than we think. They're still the puppet masters. They have trillions of dollars of gold, literally, and buying more every day. And functionally no Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies. That's something we all have to keep in the back of our mind.
Yeah, I think you did a great job of, you know, really, really painting that picture or let's say the stark difference between Bitcoin and what a CBDC is, right? And the amount of control that ends up giving, you know, somebody like the Federal Reserve. How does the incentive structure for the commercial banks, how does that incentive structure, you know, really go against how the commercial banks end up interacting with the economy?
So there's a huge amount of control dictated by, at least the U.S. market, which I understand more than I do other markets. But I'll conclude that it's largely the same. Government policy with respect to how reserves are marked at banks and things like policy rates, and open market interventions really influence how, or allow the government to influence how banks act. And something as seemingly innocuous as how reserves are marked and treated has a profound impact and multiplier effect through the economy. So they exert tremendous influence that way already. When they have CBDCs, look, there's a disintermediation of the banks. The governments are actually, we're now closer to the government and less of a disintermediation through the banking system than we had before. So that is another huge disruption. And that's another, you know, again, we may think they look like they're sort of caught in a time warp or bumbling idiots at times, but the heads of the big banks are incredibly informed, intelligent, well-connected individuals, and they understand the world changing underneath their feet, mm-hmm. and that cryptocurrencies are no small part of it. So it is the smoke alarm blinking red and sounding the siren right now. The fact that you have hundreds of billions or even trillions of dollars of wealth being accumulated in cryptocurrencies around the world, and maybe that all gets wiped out at some point, but it's out there and it's working, and it's we can see where the system's headed. And it's going to fundamentally change how banks work. And it may very well be all CBDCs. We may be in a world with no Bitcoin, or we may be in a world where Bitcoin's incredibly important. Either way, those banks' role is probably greatly diminished and fundamentally changed.
Ravi, it's interesting to be having this discussion today. You know, fresh on my mind is a conversation that I listened to yesterday between Tom Luongo and Vince Lancey. And they were talking about Bitcoin, hedging, the miners, you know, and how that kind of translates into the gold miners as well. You know, you're the chairman of Golconda Gold. And it strikes me as interesting to try to understand, let's say, the verbiage on the website, that you guys are an unhedged gold producer. So what does that mean, and why be unhedged in this market?
So I'll give a pedestrian answer, and then I'll give the great big plan answer. So the pedestrian one is I'll put my, you know, 20 years ago money manager hat on. And if I'm investing in a gold company, I'm not investing in it because I think gold is a fantastic business. Gold mining is in the running. It's at least in the conversation for being the worst possible business in the world. Like with airlines, got to be up there somewhere, gold miners, stiff competition. Why is that? You know, why do I say gold mining? Gold is a different beast. There, you know, why are BHP and Rio Tinto and the global mining giants not involved in gold? Because they're involved in great mining businesses, bulk commodities. You have a huge reserve life. You have big logistics operations moving things like potash, coal, iron ore, even to a lesser extent, nickel and copper. These are usually much more pedestrian ore bodies or easily understood ore bodies. And they're almost like earth moving logistics operations. Like how big can I make it? And how effective and cost compelling are my logistics? Those are businesses that somebody can invest in and say, I'm investing in this for the next 30 years. Gold ore bodies look like they're sort of drawn by a three-year-old with a crayon, totally unpredictable in many cases, very hard to find, much shorter reserve lives and volumes than you'd find in coal or potash or iron ore, these bulk commodities. So it's an incredibly difficult business. If I'm investing in one of those, and even a great one that's a big company that's got 10 mines or 15 mines or something like that, I'm not investing because I think gold mining is a great business and this is a great management team. I'm primarily investing because I think gold's going higher. And if you're not investing for that reason, you're investing because you think it's like well run or it's undervalued or something like that, you're nuts. You shouldn't be doing that. You should not be buying those shares. So that, I just said the most basic level, we're not trying to build the next Toyota with the gold mining company. We're trying to give people exposure to gold price in mm-hmm. a levered one. Gold price goes up. It's not just your revenue goes up. Of course it does, but your margin. So, you know, maybe the industry-wide cost 2 years from now is $1,500 an ounce. So at $2,000 gold, you get a $500 margin. At $3,000 gold, your revenues went up by 50%, but your margin tripled. Mm-hmm. So you have a multiplier effect there. You also have another exponential effect, which is at $3,000 gold versus $2,000, your reserves expand and your reserve life's extended. So you have an exponential upside. So you have tremendous torque out of investing in gold mines. perversely, the higher the cost of the operation, the more torque you have. So this has been the attraction to juniors all along. So that's kind of the basic fundamental answer of why unhedged. The bigger master plan answer, and it has not worked out for me thus far, but I'm more confident than I've ever been, is that in my case, I try to design a company that gives me massive operational leverage to gold price, because I think gold price is going higher, much higher. And I wanted to design a company, an instrument for me to invest in and get behind and back. I'm a large shareholder. My family is a very large shareholder in the company that's going to perform exponentially with gold price. And, you know, here's where we intersected that comparison I made to the airline industry of being like one of the most miserable types of businesses to run. It's incredibly hard. We started the business in August of 2011, literally the month that gold was at its peak, and we're producing Gold Company, and it went down basically for half a decade, and it went down by half. And I try to give the analogy to people. If imagine Toyota, which makes a lot of Corollas, great car. They're great at making it. And you know, over a 5-year period, instead of being able to charge $30,000 for a Corolla, they had to, all their costs went up, but they can only get $15,000 for a Corolla. Not a good situation for Toyota. Mm-hmm. Great company doing all the right stuff. It's just, you know, you're fighting against the impossible. And so that's a gold mining business. So that's a setback. You also have very real operating issues. You have people involved. You have physical factors and so forth. So it's not easy to do what we set out to accomplish, but now we're coming into a position where you oddly have very little interest in gold miners. You have a little bit of pressure on costs, but not like we did in the zeros, where costs for miners across the board, in particular gold miners, were going through the roof. And so even though we had gold to go from 250, 300 to 2000, the ASIC, the average cost of producing those ounces, went from 200 to over 1,000. Like it went up by the same factor. Mm-hmm. So the margin expanded for sure, and it's a better situation than $250, $300 gold. But the costs tracked pretty well as well. Now we have a situation which is shaping up where you'll still have upward pressure on costs. You're still victim of the same factors: a lower U.S. dollar, negative real rates, all those things. The cost of everything is going to go up. No question about that. But you're having a revaluation of that gold price, which is going to cause a margin expansion. And we're already seeing record margins for miners. That margin is going to get much bigger. At the same time, you're going to see them go from absolutely zero interest. Like there's just, we're not at the ground floor, we're in the sub basement now in terms of interest in gold stocks and particularly small juniors. And it's going to slingshot and it's going to go into bubble territory before this is over. Is that going to be in the next 6 months? Nope. I've been around this one long enough and I could see just the despair in the sector. Not one gold bug I've talked to in the last month has said anything but, well, we're going to get a big pull, but you're probably going to see sub 2000 again, or, you know, there's no way. Well, just raise some money while you can, because this one's not going to last. And I'll quote another great thinker, Don Cox, when those who know it the best love it the least. And that's where we are now for gold times 10. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have, at the same time, you're having record margin expansion. You have no access to capital for new mines. There's a lot of great projects sitting out there. They need $300, $400, $500 million. It's almost unthinkable. Where is that money going to come from? And the company that owns the project might have a $25 million market cap. The sourcing that capital is at this point implausible. And you go from expanding margins, very little new supply, and a fundamental revaluation going from less than zero interest to huge interest as we see those margins expand and that price continue to skyrocket. So you could have asked me the same question at any point in the last several years. I would have given you the same answer and I would have been spectacularly wrong, Tom. But this time I could say I have more faith in that position than ever. And it's, you know, we are at all time highs. It's really becoming a reality at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, you know, the reality, as you're saying that, the reality of the situation is that, you know, as we're hitting these all-time highs, as these margins are expanding, you know, maybe more than ever, granted costs are going up, but there isn't marginal supply that can come online to meet the demand of, you know, this growing interest, right? And especially when we think about the demand from the East, not only does that change the dynamic, but it's really interesting to try to understand what the supply side of the equation looks like when you can't just snap your fingers and bring new supply on to the market.
It's one of the beautiful things about how Bitcoin is designed, and several other cryptocurrencies have sort of mimicked it or tried to pick up the best elements of Bitcoin. It's to anybody who's lived and breathed the gold industry, it looks a lot like gold. So you do have an increasing supply. It's limited though, and it's increasingly expensive to bring on additional supply. Mm-hmm. So while you're trickled new supply every year at a very modest rate, it's not creating all this new supply. And if you overlay that with a situation where there's no capital and no interest in the sector for a prolonged period of time, it's a very slow process to bring that new supply on. We have another dimension to the mining industry right now, which is it's been there for 20, maybe 30 years, but it is far more acute at this point. And I could tell you, as a project developer in the renewable energy sector, it's very difficult to permit renewable energy projects from an ESG perspective. You want to permit a mine? And guess what? You know, all the mines that were in, you know, very permittable places where you would want the mine to be, most of those have been permitted and are in production or maybe even depleted by now. They're in increasingly difficult places to permit and from an ESG perspective. And the number of things that can bring it down has just continued to go up. And that is not a trend that I see changing. What could change that? Serious war conditions where we have to get a lot of critical minerals online really fast and permitting gets thrown out the window. Mm-hmm. Super spike or a change in how gold and silver or precious metals are viewed as part of our monetary system. Maybe that can have some influence. I don't see it happening. I see it continuing to go in the other direction. If it's taking me years to permit renewable energy projects, which are theoretically, you know, the greenest of the green, permitting a mine is just not easy right now. So you have that on shortage of capital, lack of projects to begin with, but shortage of capital to bring the few good ones online and dump this ESG issue on top of it. And that one's not going away. So yeah, very little supply response to mm-hmm. the higher.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I had a recent conversation with Doomberg about, you know, this idea of peak oil and a lot of the hurdles that are in place at this point are political, are these arbitrary fences that we put up rather than, you know, these physical limitations. You know, granted, there's obviously a more complex conversation to be had there, but, you know, layering this ESG, in some ways, we could almost call it a luxury of, you know, deciding what projects we're going to allow and what projects we're not, rather than the absolute necessity of those minerals, I think is an interesting intersection and thing that we need to understand about a lot of these projects.
Absolutely. It's, like I said, it's not going away. If anything, it's getting worse. It's accelerating. Mm-hmm.
So Ravi, going back to the gold mining industry, you know, what is the overall health of the mining industry and, let's say, the financing that is available for projects at this point?
Extremely poor. So, of course, we are seeing, you know, great projects will get funded. That'll happen. But there's a lot of royalty money out there. They're driving harder bargains because of the lack of capital in general. There is debt. It is available. Cost has gone up a lot in the last 2 years, but it's there. The missing slice is the equity, just a total lack of interest. And then the very real issue that if it were to be available, that equity, the royalty money, the streaming money, the debt money. The project owners are at such just depleted, rundown valuations that nobody wants to do anything. Mm-hmm. And I give the example of our project. We have a mine that we past producing mine that we own in New Mexico, and it was we need some modest amount of capital to restart it. In our company, there is absolutely no way that we'd issue equity to restart that one. Mm-hmm. And 18 months ago, there was no availability of even debt and royalty money. Now, there's a lot of people interested in the offtake of that concentrate who can provide funding. There's more availability of the debt. There's more availability of royalty money. And that's something that can come online now because we don't have to, sell our soul to try and get that into production. But that phenomenon is affecting the entire mining industry. And it's maybe even more exacerbated on the larger, more relevant projects where you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that are required. There's no appetite for it. And here's another very fundamental, basic observation. You asked about the health of the mining industry. I can't say for the very large cap or mega cap or top tier of mining companies, but intermediate and below, find me even one that's trading at or above the replacement value of its existing operations. Never mind intangible value of its reserves or mines that aren't in production. Mm-hmm. Find me one that's a producer producing record margins as we speak that's trading above its construction or replacement cost. Mm-hmm. Very hard to do. So that tells you something, that if I can buy a publicly traded miner for less than it costs to build that same miner, why am I building a new mine again?
And of course, that speaks to the health, the health, and I think the interest of this sector at this point. And, a lot of times I think it's tough for the average person to get excited about gold or the gold mining industry because of those exact issues, right?
And again, we come back to the phrases we started with: recency bias and confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. None of us have an interest in buying something that's gone down for years or even sideways. Mm-hmm. And all of us find it very difficult to not buy something that just keeps going up. And NVIDIA is the current example I'd give. Mm-hmm. How do you not want to own some of that? It's just, things that have gone up not just 10%, 20%, but hundreds of percent. Bitcoin, the FOMO around that at times when it's had its real runs. Very difficult to resist the opposite effect with the miners, but that changes. I was tasked in the late 90s with liquidating a portfolio to help out an investment group that was all junior miners, and it was probably the average share price was a nickel, and average trading volume was zero. Amongst that portfolio. And that was junior mining in the late 90s, peak of the dot-com bubble. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking to myself, do we still mine stuff? Do we still need to do this? is that a thing that we need to do? Of course, nothing's changed. If it wasn't grown, it was mined. Mm-hmm. Might be made out of oil, but it's something that's been dug out of the ground on some shape or form. And that's most of our world. So yes, we do still need to mine stuff, but nobody cared. And those stocks that I helped liquidate in the late 90s, they didn't go from a nickel to 10 cents or double, or they didn't go to a dollar. Some of them went to $30, $15. They went up hundreds or thousands of percent. And that's the leverage to junior mining. It's true boom or bust. Nothing happens, and then it happens, and it happens in a big way. And paraphrase Hemingway, as people are fond of doing, how did it happen? Very slowly at first, and then all of a sudden. And that's mm-hmm. exactly how it's going to be for mining, and it'll be on steroids. It'll be absolutely amplified for the junior end of the sector, where we see the 5 cents and the 10 cent stocks, the ones that are fantastic projects, will go on to be $15, $20, and $25. And the ones, and many of the ones that are complete nonsense, will be 50 cents or a dollar. So the gains will be across the board. The rising tide will float every boat.
It's interesting that you mentioned your perspective of not understanding that we still mine things. I had a recent conversation with this young guy. He was about 19 years old. Very, very intelligent kid, you know, knows a lot about, you know, computers and his area of expertise. And somehow we got into this discussion of copper. And his statement to me was that we don't mine copper anymore. We just recycle it. And I had to explain to him how many thousands and thousands of tons of copper ore are still mined every day. And the reality of the situation definitely kind of blew his mind. It's so interesting to actually pull back the veil for some people on the reality of this situation. You know, I shared a story with you about the reality of talking about some of these situations, whether it be the green energy transition that California has a goal of. And, you know, it just comes back to mining and needing these raw materials.
Absolutely. Copper is one of the most basic and examples where it was a great chart that I was shown by someone at SNC-Lavalin years ago. And it was a simple chart, which on one axis was the amount of power generated, the total generation capacity of an economy. Mm-hmm. And the other axis was the GDP. And it was a plot, but it was basically a 45 degree angle. So the more power you generated, the more GDP you had. And so the question is it the chicken or is it the egg? Do you have more generation capacity so you have more GDP, or you have more GDP so you need more power generation capacity? And I thought the really insightful answer is, I don't know, but that's not the answer. The answer is they're correlated one-to-one. Mm-hmm. So if you want more GDP, you need more power generation capacity. Fact. And our world digitizing, becoming more electric, more electronic on every front, the amount of power that we require with the energy transition is a non-decreasing function of time. In fact, it's a rapidly increasing function of time. AI is another turbo boost on top of that. So you have the power generation requirement going like this. And if that chart holds, there'll be some lags and there'll be some chaos and bumps in that road. But that means our GDP should also track materially higher. What do we need to move that power around, to store it, to generate it? Copper. And that copper, if we're using all that copper now for the generation that we have currently in all our buildings and all our transmission systems and all our electronics and all our digital world, and we're only adding more, sure, we're recycling, we're getting more efficient and not wasting product, but it's, again, a non-decreasing function of time. In fact, a rapidly increasing function of time. So it's one of the more interesting ones, less abstract than gold, for sure, to wrap our heads around and say, boy, do we need a lot more copper? Where the heck is it going to come from? And the same issues. Capital markets don't care. No money available for the equity. ESG is a huge problem because these are even bigger footprint, large mines that are needed. All of the above still apply to copper. Same story. Mm-hmm.
Ravi, it's interesting, you know, to speak with you. You really have your fingers in so many pieces of this pie. You know, you're chairman and co-founder of Abraxas Power Corp. Explain to us a little bit about what the third phase of the renewable energy transition is.
Absolutely. And we hear the term energy transition, and I break it down into three phases. The first phase was I'll call it the subsidy era. Mm-hmm. And what do I mean by that? So guys like me developing projects in the renewable sector, we're totally dependent on government subsidies. And that was a lot of criticism for the sector. You needed, if the economics don't hold up, it can't compete with fossil fuels, totally dependent on government. What are we doing this for? All those very reasonable and mathematically accurate criticisms. But the fact was, we were creating an entirely new industry. Somebody's got to be the first guy to build a panel plant, to build turbines, to install, start a project. And without those subsidies, none of them would have been economic. They just, none of them would have happened. So that was the first era. Second era, this one, is where economics ruled the day. And I call it, I point out, if you want to go surfing, you can't go to any beach. You got to go to a beach that's got waves. Mm-hmm. And same thing for renewables. So you want to build a solar plant that makes money, it better be sunny. So you, with subsidies generally melted away, there's very few left for traditional renewables around the world. There's still some, but almost nothing. And its economics are ruling the day. So we're doing projects where it's incredibly sunny and we can make solar projects that absolutely clobber fossil fuels, never mind any green or carbon benefit or anything like that. This is straight up economics. If it's sunny, the price of technology's come down, the efficiency's gone up, and we're surfing on beaches that have big waves now. That's the second phase. Third phase is to unlock the next level is we have to be able to move electrons. So generate electricity over here where it's really cheap to generate electricity and we can permit it and ESG works and all that sort of stuff and move it over here with the kind of efficiency that the fossil fuel industry has, moving oil around Earth and even gas. That's a big part of phase three, and also solving for maybe the most fundamental issue of renewables is, which we call in the industry, intermittency. So if it's not windy and it's not sunny, well, it's not solving your problem. You still need power. And how do we solve for that? So we do that with storage, and storage means not just power walls in our garage and batteries, big cubes of exotic metals, but also gravity storage. I'll call it chemical storage, hydrogen, ammonia, other ways to store energy, other ways to create energy efficiency around it by taking a page out of the crypto book and more widely distributing and decentralizing energy generation so it's closer to the user when the user needs it. So all of these things are, it's a big blanket term, energy transition or third wave or third phase, as I call it. But they all combine to really unlocking the next bit of efficiency and capacity out of the renewable industry. And it's super exciting. And it's, the technologies are new, but they're not bleeding edge. This is, pretty straightforward stuff. We're just applying it in ways that are only now becoming economic.
Mm-hmm. It seems that storage is the biggest hurdle at this point, I think. From your perspective, are there any really interesting solutions to that problem that you're looking at?
So we're spending a lot of time focused on the hydrogen and ammonia market. For the most part, if you compare this apples to apples with fossil fuels, it is not competitive. It is not a competitive way to move energy around the earth. The infrastructure doesn't exist to do it. The cost of generating it on a green basis is, again, you're going to end up with a product that just on an apples to apples basis in the spreadsheet is just way more expensive than fossil fuel. And we're in, while we're in that phase three, we're in a phase one again, if you will, where to stimulate that industry, you're going to see a lot of government subsidies. Government of Canada and the United States are probably the leaders. Along with Western Europe, Germany in particular, and creating programs to stimulate that. That's an area where, again, all those same arguments apply, but it's not economic compared to oil and gas. What are we doing this for? You can't compete. Mm-hmm. Correct. We can't compete now. It's a new industry. We don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the capacity. We haven't learned how to do it. The efficiencies aren't there. Fast forward 20 years, you won't recognize it. And, we'll be amazed at the ubiquitousness of green ammonia and green hydrogen. So that's, an area my company's spending a lot of time on. I think I'll call it the battery type storage. That is, we're just going to see it everywhere. It's just going to be, it helps us distribute and decentralize that power generation and make that power available when we need it. The efficiencies are only going to get better. The different kind of materials we're going to use is going to expand. And we're going to have, in that journey, we're going to have a lot of chaos. There's going to be shortages. There's going to be ESG challenges. There's going to be very real sustainability challenges around those things. Those are all walls of worry to climb and huge opportunities from an investor standpoint. Gold, and precious metals, I think definitely one of the most interesting areas to invest in right now is these battery metals and other critical rare earths. Part of this, electrification of the world, and there's not enough of them. And as I said, it's going to be a lot of chaos and a lot of challenges on the journey from where we are today to what things are going to look like in 20 years. That means a lot of opportunities for investors.
Mm-hmm. Ravi, I think an overarching theme of our conversation today is really this cyclical nature of the commodities business, this time of underinvestment and under care, under interest in the sector. Do you see this applying to the entire commodities sector as a whole, whether that be, you know, food, whether it be mining? Do you see this really commodity super cycle applying at this time again?
Yeah, and we have, I'll call it a double whammy. So in the coming out of the 90s, you had a double or triple whammy as well, where you had an intersection of that, the cyclicality, mm-hmm. the high degree of cyclicality of the mining sector, overlay that with this sort of once in a generation or once in a lifetime growth in demand coming principally from China and more generally from emerging markets, overlaid with a very real effect caused by a final last gasp and depletion of Soviet era stockpiles. So all three factors, probably the last ones are the least significant, but at the margin, still very important, all happening at the same time. Here we have another double whammy and a big one. We've had years of underinvestment, and you have that very weak supply side response. And at the same time, we're having this huge monetary situation facing a once in a generation or even broader debasement of paper currencies, and therefore repricing of physical assets like hard commodities happening at the same time. So you have that double whammy. As that plays out, people ask me, where's the price of this going? I don't know, but I know which direction the arrow's pointed.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ravi, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap up today's conversation. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our audience with to think about?
Well, just that this is at this point in where we are economically, this is something that all of us should be thinking about. Whether it's like, what am I doing in my life and with my financial position that's going to set me up? Because, you know, this could just have really profound effects on a huge number of people. Like I said earlier, this isn't long-term capital in 1998 blowing up or Asian currency crisis in 97. This is the GFC 2007-2008 and on a greater magnitude for sure. It's really going to change in a profound and meaningful way the financial situation for a huge percentage of the population, particularly the middle class. So just something I encourage everybody to spend more time than they have ever done thinking about money and where their assets are sitting for the next 1 year, the next 10 years, the next 25 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate you helping illuminate that conversation and adding to it for us. Of course, Ravi, you're not really, let's say, a socials guy anymore. You don't do a whole lot of interviews, but share with us where people can find more of you or more information on the companies that you're on the boards of.
Yeah, BraxisPower.com, GoldCondaGold.com, for sure, my two primary companies that I'm involved in the renewable sector and gold mining. Otherwise, yes, Tom, I am a bit of a ghost. But great speaking with you today. It was always a pleasure and really enjoyed it.
Well, I really enjoyed the conversation as well, Ravi. It was, you know, definitely very wide ranging and made me think a lot. You know, I usually come to these conversations very prepared. And I would say, you know, a good three quarters of our conversation today was completely unscripted or unnoted on my part. And I really appreciate being able to have that excellent conversation with you today, Ravi.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.